This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. My co-host Craig Blumenschein is on vacation. Coming up in the second half of today's show, NPR's Rachel Martin is out with a new show, Wild Card, where she and her guests get real vulnerable real fast. But we are going to start today with an accelerator program aimed at helping Indigenous creatives launch businesses. This is being run in North Dakota through Strengthen ND. They have invested in Native Max to host a creative Indigenous cohort in the state. You can find out more at strengthenND.com or at creativesindigenous.nativemax.com for how to apply. The next cohort gets going here in just a couple of weeks, and there is still room for applications. We're visiting today with Brenna Ortiz. She is a program manager and writer for Native Max magazine. Brenna, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you for the invitation. We're really excited to kind of just share a little bit more about the work that we do and our organization.
There is so much to pick apart in the work that you do and how the work that you do helps other people do the work that they want to do. So Let's start with what you are doing at Native Max magazine, an Indigenous fashion magazine. But that is really over simplifying what it is you're actually doing.
Yeah, definitely. So actually, I ended up getting my position with Native Max as a writer. So I did briefly write for Native Max, but I actually got pulled away from writing to be able to help lead our program, Creatives Indigenous, which is an accelerator program for Native entrepreneurs who are in creative industries. So we work directly with a lot of different artists across North America. And also we just ended up having our last cohort internationally in New Zealand. So we did a cohort that was amongst Maori entrepreneurs in New Zealand and Native entrepreneurs here in North America. And so part of the work that we do is just to help Indigenous entrepreneurs establish the foundation of their business, because we believe that artists can be business owners too. You know, sometimes there's just like a lack of resources, especially when it comes to working in creative industries.
Well, it's interesting that you said a lack of resources, because my mind went right to, it's just such a different brain, it's such a different mindset to be sort of career oriented and business minded versus to be very artistic and flowy. So let's address both of those here. Is there as much of a gap between how the different brain types work as I might think there is? And then what would be some of the resources that you address?
Yeah, so, you know, as far as the Western world of thinking goes in like educational institutions, most of the business courses aren't Native led. They don't have Indigenous knowledge embedded into the curriculum. And so we feel as though that being able to fill that gap is important, especially with Native entrepreneurs, because it incorporates their culture into their business rather than, you know, the Western way of thinking. And so that's what we really try to do, is just incorporate Indigenous knowledge into the curriculum, so that way it is as pure and, how do I say it? Culturally led, culturally advised as possible. So that way it's more relatable. As far as, you know, an artist brain and a business brain goes, I think they go hand in hand. It's just more so about decolonizing the way that we think about business, incorporating your cultural aspects into your business.
How do these cohorts work?
So our cohorts are about 6 weeks long. We do a kickoff event at the beginning of it, so that way we can meet everybody, get in touch with them, have that one-on-one, like, personal interaction with each other. And then every class after that is every Tuesday, Thursday evening via Zoom. And we host the sessions, the course sessions, like on Tuesday evenings. And then Thursday evenings, we have a mentor that comes and joins us. And we kind of just do an open discussion with the mentor, the entrepreneurs, participants in the program. So that way they can have the opportunity to network in those ways.
We are visiting today with Brenna Ortiz. She is a program manager and a writer with Native Max Magazine and will be helping to lead a cohort for creatives indigenous. This is being run in North Dakota through the program Strengthen ND, and you can find out more on the Strengthen ND's website. Do you have specific artists or entrepreneurial types in mind when you go into a cohort like this?
Not specifically. We try to work with as many different, artists or creatives in any medium, because we believe that creativity isn't necessarily held in a box. So we worked with anyone between like graphic designers, fashion designers, people who work in culinary, writers, poets, like I said, all different mediums, because, you know, there's a way that they can create their own business depending on what, you know, their passion is. And we just try not to limit anybody.
I was playing around on the website nativemaxmagazine.com, and I noticed some of the other services that you are providing. And I'm noticing things like coaching and mentoring. Just real quick, what is the distinction between coaching someone and mentoring someone?
I would definitely say mentoring is, you know, just providing wisdom, guidance. I think coaching will require you to kind of like give a little bit more of like a pep talk in a way, you know, building that other person up. But regardless, they go both hand in hand. If you're looking for somebody to mentor you off a specific subject, that guidance is, it's not as pressurized, I guess. Coaching can maybe be kind of tied into, you know, it's usually used with sports, I feel like. So just between the two, I think that one just requires a little bit more of a, like, pick me up. Help me.
Pick me up, help me. Yeah, those are two words that a lot of people don't want to say, particularly that sort of, and maybe this is a Western mindset thing, and I'm not sure, and I hope that you will correct me if I'm misspeaking here, but this idea that we shouldn't have to ask for help, that we should just have to pick ourselves up by the bootstraps. Do you run into that a lot when you're working with creatives? I feel like so often I hear a phrase like imposter syndrome among all the people who are doing the coolest things.
Yeah, imposter syndrome is very real. You know, you get put into these maybe positions, or your business might take off and it feels as though you might not be deserving of that. We've come across that within our cohorts before. And, you know, that comes, you know, from a place in which Indigenous people specifically were never valued for their art. You know, now the ways of the world are changing, you know, Native fashion is on the rise, Native art is on the rise. There's more appreciation for that rather than appropriation, I would say.
Sure.
And so definitely just trying to change that dynamic of, you know, whether or not we belong in these spaces, because we do, we've always had these spaces. You know, now it's just becoming more respected. For sure.
Yeah.
But knowing our worth is key to that, for sure.
When did you feel like you most knew your worth, or what does it feel like when you're standing in your power is maybe a better, that makes it more present tense, more active.
That's a great question, because it fluctuates amongst everyone. You know, we always end up facing insecurity, or we might feel as though like the things that we put out into the world aren't seen maybe, but I think really just embodying, like, just being able to create rather than creating in the eyes of someone else. Like, being an artist is more so about just creating something for the sake of, like, where your heart space is, you know, because everything that we do should come from there. Well, at least that's what I believe. And at the end of the day, searching for validation doesn't require you, or like, to create. Like, creating doesn't have to be based off of validation, right? It's more so about doing what you love. And really pulling that into a business is essential, especially whenever we're trying to build a new way of thinking about business, entrepreneurship, especially in Native communities.
Yeah. When you say build a new way, can you expand on that?
Yeah, for sure. Just kind of tapping into what I was saying earlier about the Western way of thinking of business, you know, like, oftentimes, like, we see our friends or, like, even family sometimes as competition, you know, if we're creating or doing some of the same work. And, you know, really it's about supporting each other rather than tearing each other down. And we really try to put that into the curriculum, into the cohort. We really try to do everything very community-based. And so just kind of reframing the ways of thinking about business, like, it's not a competition.
Mm-hmm.
It's a way to support each other and, you know, help each other.
Yeah.
Is essential.
There is that thing though, where businesses are supposed to make money. How do you talk to the groups? And I don't know how much you get into detail into that, into these cohorts, but talk to us about how you talk about money in these instances, if you would.
Yeah, I think the ways that we talk about it is it's an energy, you know. You know, whatever you're putting out there, if you're putting like your full intention into it, you know, those things will come back to you. Mm. And that's really how we try to discuss money per se.
Yeah.
Because it at the end of the day, it is something that you attract. Now, depending like on your work ethic and things like that, like it varies sometimes, but it's all about intention at the end of the day.
We're visiting today with Brenna Ortiz, a program manager and writer for Native Max Magazine. She's also helping to lead an upcoming cohort focusing on growing Indigenous businesses in the state of North Dakota. You can find out more at creativesindigenous.nativemax.com or on the strengthennd.com website. The cohort gets going in mid-May and there is still room for participants. And Brenna, I want to go back to what we were just talking about, this thing about money and changing the mindset around it to be sort of this energy. And I've heard phrases like that a lot with people who are working in any sort of creative industry, is that it can be really hard to set a price for something because you have to realize that you actually put a piece of your soul into it. You put a piece of your heart into it. And when you use words like it was the intention, And it maybe is something that you lost 30 hours of sleep over, and then somebody says, well, I don't want to pay $70 for it. Mm-hmm. That can be such a difficult part. Do you Do you ever wonder, or do you ever wish we could run cohorts for the other end of this, for the how to be a good consumer and realize what we could be looking at a little differently?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. I think, honestly, something that I've realized is that being in these spaces, it can get a little intimidating by seeing someone's price. But if you really love their art and you really love their work, you know, you will buy it because that's like appreciating their art and they're naming their price. So that means you appreciate them as an individual and you respect them. And there's a lot of that within our cohorts, you know, like everybody is so supportive. Like I said, we do this very community-based. So a lot of our alumni are still connected with each other. They still keep in touch. They still keep in touch with us. And we really just try to build the space where everybody can, you know, it doesn't matter how long you talk to that person. You know, they offer different services sometimes. So they always end up reconnecting at some point later on down the line. And they all really respect each other and value each other's work.
Yeah. I want to go back to Native Max magazine here, because at the beginning I said, you know, an indigenous fashion magazine, and we both sort of agreed that that is oversimplifying the work. And even on the website, it says, you know, it's not a magazine, it's a movement. And, you know, if I look through something like Cosmo or Vogue or whatever, it just sort of feels... like
oversaturated.
Well, like they're, like they're trying to tell me that I'm wrong, that I'm missing something, that I'm somehow not good enough. I don't get that sense from your magazine. Your magazine feels very celebratory, which can be very difficult given the legacy of centuries of racism. How do you stay so positive?
Yeah, I think one of the main things that Kelly, our founder and CEO of Native Max, that she wants to do is highlight the positive Indigenous stories. And, you know, the world's already hard. Things are already hard. on, you know, as on individuals as a whole. And so I think just really spreading the good word about our people is more important than highlighting negative aspects, I guess. But at the end of the day, it is a change in mindset because, you know, we're not like, oh, well, we're going to write about the 10 worst looks we saw this weekend at the fashion show. You know what I mean? Like, that's so, that's just not who we are as people. And I think we try to do a really good job about just highlighting positive stories rather than tearing other people down or talking about someone else's work.
Who are you watching? And it doesn't have to be fashion. You have artists, like musicians and stuff featured in the magazine, but you're in a very privileged position to be watching all of these young artists coming up in the world. Who catches your eye?
There's a few makeup artists that I really like. I do makeup too. I mean, I adore makeup, so that's just one of the things I always keep out for. Anchovy on Instagram, Little Coyote, he's an artist, Rebecca Jarvie, Jillian Waterman, just to name a few, for sure.
Brenna Ortiz helping run the Creatives Indigenous Cohort. This is an accelerator program that is part of the Creative Community Solutions Grantmaking Program through Strengthen ND. You can find out more at strengthenND.com, or you can find out more and apply through creativesindigenous.nativemax.com. Brenna is also program manager and a writer with Native Max Magazine. Learn about that at nativemaxmagazine.com. Brenna, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. We really appreciate you inviting us on, and it's been a really, truly an honor to be able to come on here and talk with you and share just a little bit more about Native Max and Creatives Indigenous.
We'll have Tom Mizern after this break.
Support for Pray Public is provided by Josh Beauchesne, broker and realtor with Real Broker LLC. With a team of agents serving homebuyers, sellers, and investors throughout North Dakota, the Detroit Lakes area, and northwest Minnesota. Josh can be reached at 701-367-3513. And by AARP North Dakota, fighting fraud, promoting financial resilience, and offering local events designed with you in mind. AARP North Dakota is helping your money, health, and happiness live as long as you do. Learn more at aarp.org/nd.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Historians, as the name implies, like history, but often there is one particular period that they like, and many historians do seem to like the rich world of Prohibition. Here's a Plains Folk essay from Tom Ezern, The Blind Pigger's Farewell.
Prohibition, as a historical subject, is easy to caricature. Shifty bootleggers, dauntless G-men, assumptions of futility. We like the broad strokes of how Prohibition, established constitutionally in 1889, went down here in North Dakota. We love to tell the romantic stories of rum runners along the Canadian border and booze wagons crossing Red River. On the ground, the action was fraught with contradiction and complexity. I learned a lesson about the folkways of Prohibition at the grassroots when I discovered, quite accidentally, a ballad about it. Blind Pigger's Farewell to Benson County, as published in the Bismarck Tribune of May 7, 1907. The ballad is signed, but with a pseudonym, Rye M. Stir, which is a double or triple entendre. Rye, as in whiskey, of course, but say Rye M. Stir fast, and you get, of course, Rhymester, our balladeer. His subject, however, is no joke. It seems that blind pigs operated in many towns, especially in the western part of the state. Now, a blind pig was an illegal saloon, like a speakeasy, but even more out in the open. Some of them also harbored gambling and other vices. The Women's Christian Temperance Union was an effective educational and political organization, but it could not defeat the blind piggers on their own turf. That task fell to its men's auxiliary, the Law Enforcement League. The League, a citizen association, deployed agents known as spotters into speakeasy territory to pose as customers and gather information, which would be given to law enforcement. This only worked if you had a state's attorney and a county sheriff willing to act. In 1906, the legislature strengthened the state prohibition law. Honest John Burke was elected governor, and Benson County got a state's attorney named W.H. Thomas, pledged to crack down on the blind piggers. He was allied with Sheriff John S. Acre. And crack down they did in early 1907. They shut down the open shipments of beer that came to local depots, arrested blind pig operators, and even stopped the profligate sale of alcohol dealt to prominent citizens with sympathetic physicians and cooperative pharmacists. To which developments our balladeer responded in verse, and so his rhyme began. Say, Bill, we're up against it now, I'm going to leave tonight. Our palmy days are gone for good, you'd better fly or kite. The state's attorney's after us, that's straight from one who knows. It's me for Minnesota, where the swift Budweiser flows. Leeds, Brinsmade, Minnewaukan, Esmond, all were within reach of the long arm of the law. Prominent citizens called in for questioning, beer shipments seized, the druggists caving, and the blind piggers, as the ballad details, fleeing the territory. It was remarkable how quickly the booze business collapsed under legal pressure. Key to the enforcement campaign were the spotters of the Law Enforcement League. We should hear more about these guys next week.
Still to come on Main Street, take smart, talented, wildly interesting people and give them a deck of cards to answer questions from. It's the new premise of a show from NPR's Rachel Martin. That's coming up after this.
Hi, I'm Jack Zaleski. I'm the former editorial page editor and a current columnist for the Forum of Fargo-Moorhead, and I've been a newspaper man for life. But no matter what the media and public radio is included, journalism is a vital pillar of democracy. We're seeing what happens with a superpower whose leader goes unchecked by a free and independent press. We've seen democracy and the media under attack right here in this country. It is always important to support your trusted sources of journalism. So keep reading and subscribing to your area newspapers, digital or in print. Become a member of your local public radio station, Prairie Public. And we journalists will continue to seek the truth no matter what we uncover.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Think about the most fascinating conversations you've ever had. And then think about getting to have those kinds of conversations over and over again. Well, if you are as lucky and talented enough to be NPR's Rachel Martin, you get to do that in this podcast, Wildcard. The former national security correspondent turned host of Morning Edition is out with this new podcast on Thursday, where she gets to interview artists and musicians, among many others. The premise of the show is that they have a deck of cards divided into three categories, and the guests get to pick a card. Now, Rachel gets to ask a follow-up, of course, but it gets to some pretty deep places pretty quickly. I caught up with Rachel to talk about the new show. Rachel, thank you so much for joining us today.
You are so welcome. Thank you for having me.
It's a great idea. I won't lie, a little bit of professional jealousy that I didn't have the idea myself here. Where did the idea come from?
Oh, I mean, to be honest, I have to give a lot of credit to my producer, Lee Hale. He and I have been thinking about a way to have meaningful existential questions and meaningful existential conversations with people in a way that wouldn't feel heavy. You know what I mean? Because a lot of times those questions can go to places that might feel really serious, profound and beautiful, but too much of it can be tough.
Yeah.
And so it was his idea to think about what is a way that we can make a game out of this.
Yeah, it's funny because the word existential, in my mind, immediately the next word is crisis.
Right. But a lot of this came out of my own process where I'm at in my life. And I had hosted these NPR news shows for a long time and needed a change, to be perfectly honest. Talk about heavy. The news has been heavy. I don't know if anyone's noticed. And then I had a personal loss. My dad died unexpectedly and my mom had died a long time ago. And I felt unmoored. And I found myself, as the parent of young kids, thinking about these big existential questions. How do I explain this stuff to them? You know, what happens when we die? What is our purpose on this earth? What does it mean to be a good person and lead a happy life? And so that was my take on existentialism. I wasn't in crisis, but it felt like these were the questions I was really stuck in. And I wanted to think about them with other people. And when I talked to friends about this stuff, I found that they were swimming around in the same existential goo, you know? And so I thought, well, maybe we're not alone. Maybe other people. And whether it's post-pandemic and we were isolated from each other for so long and still haven't really recovered from that psychic wound, and the relentlessness of the news, I just thought, let's create a different place in the NPR ecosystem in particular, where it's about something different. It's about interior lives. It's about questions that, to some degree or another, I am convinced all of us wrestle with.
It's a really fascinating premise, and one thing that really stuck out to me was the option for the guests to make you answer the question first. I want to talk to you, Rachel, about this role of doing something that you are asking other people to do, which in this case is to be intensely vulnerable, not something you're usually doing, at least not in your former roles on the air. Why was that so important to you for the success of the show?
I have several answers to that question. One, when you're doing an interview on a news show, it's not a conversation. We like to call them conversations. They're not. There's because there's a power imbalance. Like the interviewer has the power. And it's also not the interviewer's role to make themselves part of the story. And I'm doing this thing now, this game, and asking people to be revealing and honest. And it only seems fair that if I'm asking our guests to come and present that way and be that way, that I should do the same thing. Hmm. So I really did long for some kind of equity in that way, you know? and I wanted to be a player, and it also makes it like surprising. Yeah. You know? It's just I don't know what's gonna come up, Ashley. I have to be prepared for any question in the deck to be flipped on me. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it feels a little scary sometimes, and intimidating. But it also feels kind of liberating to be able to do that. And I come out of these conversations. I mean, it's crazy. It's a person I've never met before. And we have this talk and we go to these crazy places and these deep places.
So
and
fast.
And I'm sharing and they're sharing. Yeah, so fast. It's like a shortcut. But that's the point, is that often in an interview, you know, set aside the news interviews on the news magazines, but like an interview you would do with a musician or an artist or a person, just a human who's gone through a thing.
Yeah.
You're looking for this one connection, right? Like it's all in service. It's all in service to like this, oh man, that one moment, that driveway moment we say in public radio, right?
Sure.
And I just wanted all of it. I want all those all the time. And so this format is a way to just go, get there quicker. And so I'm having a great time.
Well, the format of the show, Rachel, it can be a slippery slope to have a premise and a format and a gimmick. Talk about the show development and how you came to a place of landing on a premise, and do you worry about it sliding into that territory of kind of gimmicky?
I don't even care. Like, I'm so into this idea that I don't even care. Like, let's just try it, right? Like, let's just try. Sometimes you just have to take a risk. And I will admit to you, when my producer first came to me with this idea, I was like, really? Can I just talk to people? Like, all I really want to do is just talk to people. Do we have to do it in this? Can't we just do it straight? And I was convinced, like, after the first time we tried it out, something magical happened. We did it with a friend and colleague, Felix Contreras of NPR Music. Felix is a friend of mine. We brought him on to do this to see if it would even work. And it worked better. I'm telling you, it was better than if I had just sat down to talk with Felix about his life. It gave me permission, instead of working your way rhetorically up to certain places, and like, what are the exact words that I need to use to get to this emotional place? I just get to go. I just draw another card and we're there. So it feels like cheating. And I'm into it.
Yeah, permission is such a funny word. Do the guests know the premise when you're booking them? Like, you have to be...
Yes, it is an automatic vetting mechanism. You are either into this or you are not. And by all means, I am not interested in plumbing anyone's trauma or going through any door you do not want to walk through voluntarily. That is not my game. And that is not what this is.
Yeah.
But if you are into this idea and you're working through things and you are into the, and you, if you buy into the premise of the show, which is my premise, that talking out loud about stuff helps people feel less alone. when you talk through issues or problems or your beliefs or how you see the world and the muckiness of it, and you're not afraid to put that out into the world, not everyone's going to do that. Are you kidding? I've talked to some people who are like, this is horrible. This is my worst nightmare. I don't want to share that stuff. That is okay. Because you can listen at home and you can ask these questions of yourself. Mm. No one's asking you to say that into a microphone. Yeah. But there are a lot of people, professional storytellers on the whole, who are asking these questions of themselves, and they're willing to come on and do this and share these conversations with me. And I think it's to our collective benefit when people share. It makes us feel less isolated.
Do you think the show might have hit differently in a pre-pandemic world?
Yeah. Hard to know. But I think so. I don't think I would have come up with it. Mm. I don't know that I would have. Again, you can't... It's hard to engage in a thing that didn't happen, but I think the pandemic really had a lot of bearing on it. And where we are in our culture, I mean, we live in a time when everybody is broadcasting all their feelings, right? There's so many feelings, and everyone's on Instagram, and everyone's on the things. And, you know, there's some oversaturation in that department. Yeah. And so I don't, and overly confessional. So there's a line to walk for sure. But this is an NPR show, and I felt really strongly that NPR needed this because we as an organization claim to represent and help you tap into your 360 degrees of humanity, of what it means to be human through news and music and culture. And we didn't have anything that really tapped into our interior lives this way. And so, you know, let's try it.
Professional risk taking.
Yeah, why not?
Rachel Martin, thank you so much for your time today.
It was such a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you for having me.
NPR's Rachel Martin about her new podcast, Wildcard, which launches on Thursday. Poetry from Studio 47 is next.
I'm Martha Barnett.
And I'm Grant Barrett.
And we are co-hosts of Away With Words.
I think the best thing about the audience is all of these voices that don't get heard. These accents, these regional dialects, the old expressions from the grandmother, or the way people speak in Alaska or Maine or Hawaii, or heck, we get calls from Australia and where else? We've had calls from Japan.
And what I love about it is that our callers teach us.
That's right.
All the time. They bring us their linguistic heirlooms.
Yeah.
They bring us the slang that they've heard that we haven't heard before.
Yeah, and one piece of jargon in our workplace that we can share with the world is we call certain kinds of calls tellers, because the caller is telling us things that we didn't know. Join us every Saturday morning at 9 a.m. Central, 8 a.m. Mountain for Away With Words on member-supported Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Where we're from shapes who we become, and this seems to be particularly true among creatives. Poetry from Studio 47 comes to us from Patrick Hicks, a writer in residence and member of the English faculty at Augustana University in Sioux Falls. And today he explores how place shaped poet Joe Wilkins.
Wilkins was born and raised in a small rural town in the Big Dry area of eastern Montana on May 11, 1978. It was a rugged place to live, and it left a deep imprint on his creative imagination. After high school, Wilkins went to Gonzaga University, where he studied computer engineering. It seemed like a reliable major, and he excelled at it. But when he took a writing class, he knew that creating words was what he really wanted to do. In an interview, Wilkins had this to say: "Once I took that writing class, I knew that I wanted writing in my life." When he graduated from Gonzaga with honors, he joined Teach for America and moved to the Mississippi Delta, where he taught pre-algebra to ninth graders. Shortly afterwards, he went to the University of Idaho, where he got his MFA in creative writing. His books include Killing the Murnian Dogs, Notes from the Journey Westward, When We Were Birds, The Mountain and the Fathers, and his novel, Fall Back Down When I Die, which was recently shortlisted for the Center for Fiction's First Novel Prize. Wilkins has won the Oregon Book Award, the Boyden Award, the GLCA New Writers Award, and his work has been anthologized in the Pushcart Prize Anthology, as well as Best New Poets and Best American Magazine Writing. He is a professor at Linfield College, where he directs the Creative Writing Program. He lives in McMinnville, Oregon. Today's poem is Say. I should stop myself at this point and mention that this isn't a poem at all. However, that's the great thing about having your own show. You can bend the rules. Our work for today is actually something called flash fiction. That is, it's a very short story. What I really like about Say is the narrative voice that Wilkins employs. The narrator is creating two characters as he goes along, but he doesn't really know how the story will end. This captures a voice from the rugged Midwest and West. The imagery conveyed in this story reminds me of the highways and dusty roads that is so much a part of Middle America. I should also mention that there is a minor swear word in this story. I've changed it with Wilkins' approval so that I can read it on air. If you'd like to read the original version, please visit the Poetry from Studio 47 website. Wilkins has allowed us to reprint it there in full. This, then, is Say by Joe Wilkins. Let's say we have a man and a woman. Let's say they're riding in some old Chevy pickup, windows down, prairie earth wheeling past. Let's call it Nebraska. No harm to say some old Chevy, no harm to say Nebraska. Though, to be honest, judging by the cheat grass spiking the ditches, those four cow skulls nailed down a fence post's crooked length, and the great bluescape of sky, it might be Wyoming or Montana or a Dakota. Any of those dun-colored, too wide open, go crazy or so lonesome places in the middle of America. But we'll say Nebraska. We'll say the Chevy's a faded green and has a beat-up topper on the back. We'll say the plates are nearly mudded over, the engine cranked up to a high whine. We'll say some things fell through back home, and they've heard there's work in Fort Collins. We'll say they've been on the road a long few days. We'll say that in the cramped cab of the Chevy, they're close enough to touch, but they're not touching. He drapes one hand over the wheel, reaches the other out to her, palm up, like he's trying to make a point, like he's trying to come to the point. But she's not listening. We don't even have to say that. You can see it in the way her gaze has gone as flat and vacant as these plains. See the sunburnt angle of her jaw, that quick tremble of her lip. For her sake, let's say that, finally, he shuts up. He smokes cigarette after cigarette, each one burning down faster than the last, and as the miles streak by, she has retreated to some dark place behind her eyes. It's probably fair to say they've had it hard. Not only the 400 flat, aching miles they've come since sunup in Sugar City, but his drunk father, her drunk father, the job he walked out on and wishes he had back, the 2 semesters she tried at State College and will pay for until she's 37, that thing he did so long ago in the night, that man who grabbed her wrist, the friend who loved him and whom he treated cruelly, the sister she let make her own mistakes. Yes, it must be said, like you or me or anyone, like everyone, they've had it hard. You can see it in the sharp wing his elbow makes, the way she shuts her eyes for miles and leans her head against the shuttering window glass. And just to top it off, let's say the cassette deck is broken. So for hours it's been either silence or silence. Nebraska and silence. Yes, it's been a hard goddamn day. But let's say, and it could happen, I promise you, she opens her mouth and begins to sing, "Ain't it just like the night to play tricks when you're trying to be so quiet? Say, down the next dry hill, he can't help but offer up. Freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose, and nothing ain't worth nothing, but it's free." Yes, let's say that, despite it all, they begin to sing. It's not so hard to imagine, isn't it? Not so hard to see them barreling down the road, the sun-washed wind in their faces, these getting-by tunes on their lips, out with the truckers and the kickers and the cowboy angels and a good saloon in every single town. Oh, I know, it most likely goes the other way. But listen, I'm simply telling you that the ending's not yet written. Maybe she won't get out at that gutted gas-and-go in Osceola. Maybe she won't wait until he's gone to take a leak and then cross the street and turn the corner by the dollar store and simply walk away. Maybe 2 days later, he won't meet that hatchet-faced man in a roadside bar. Maybe he won't strain bad whiskey between his teeth and clench his fist. Maybe the economies of entropy and regret won't have their way. Not today. I'm holding on here with foolish hope. I'm telling you they sing their way through Osceola, then turn south to miss that storm boiling up over the sandhills. I'm telling you they stop on the grassy banks of Little Dry Creek and splash a bit of water on their necks. Telling you they make McCook by nightfall and stop at that cut-rate motel he knows and split a quart of beer while they watch moths arc and spin through streetlights like kinfolk of stars. I'm saying that this night they undress and pull the comforter from the bed and sweat against one another and roll away to sleep as naked and tired as stones. I'm saying, in the frog-loud Nebraska night, in the pure dark of Middle West America, they dream. And his dream is of sunburned and off-brand cigarettes and a black watery silence she dives into and through and pulls him from, and with his tired arms he greets again the light. And her dream is of all the things she has ever forgotten lined up on a country porch, and only after she has touched and blessed each one can she race down the steps and slide into the front seat beside him for the ride to the river. I'm telling you, just trust me for a moment, won't you, that she wakes and hears him already in the shower, and she rises and drapes one of his shirts over her small shoulders and begins to sing. I'm telling you they sing. Listen, hear their cracked voices whirl and ring.
That was the poem Say by poet Joe Wilkins, read by Patrick Hicks. He is the host of Poetry from Studio 47, which is recorded at Augustana University and is produced by Peter Folliard. Dakota Datebook is next.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
This is Dakota Datebook for April 30th. There was a writer from Mayville who captured the essence of her town by opening her eyes to the simple beauty around her. Her name was Mary Marilla Hillstead, and her descriptions of her Mayville surroundings are both simple and profound. On this date in 1936, the Trail County Tribune published Mary Hillstead's impressions of colors in her everyday life. It is worth hearing. We don't need to go any distance to find beauty. If we stay right here, every season of the year brings its changes. Early in the spring, when most all of the fields are as black as earth can be, when the seeding is going on, you can see a square of the loveliest green where the winter rye is already growing. It looks like thick green velvet. Then, almost before the snow is gone, look at Mrs. Elkin's flowers. They will be in bloom, and Mayville will soon be covered with lilacs white and lilacs color. Our summers have balmy air and cool nights. Then comes hang time, and real perfume is in the air. When fall comes with its hustle and bustle of the combine and the hum of threshing machines, then look at the color, the yellow straw stacks and the green fields, the trees, all shades of green, brown, and yellow, and the leaves of the woodbine turn scarlet. Nowhere can you see more beautiful sunsets and northern lights. Mary Hillstead also wrote about her perspectives on wintertime in response to outsiders who read newspaper reports about blizzards and 40 degrees below zero. She would reply, "That's where you are mistaken. Our winters are looked forward to by all. This is the time of year when the busy farmer lets down. He makes his chores as handy as possible and spends the time getting acquainted with his family and his neighbor. We all know that a year with lots of snow is a healthy year. There are sleigh rides, ski tournaments, and lots of getting together with family and friend. We find time now to read the books we had to lay aside last summer. We read, too, about the floods and terrible storms in other parts of the country, and thank our lucky stars we are here in North Dakota." Any North Dakotan knows that what she wrote of the continuum of the four seasons was most certainly true. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Stephen Hoffbeck. I'm Ann Alquist.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding by Humanities North Dakota, North Dakota's largest lifelong learning community.
That's it for this Tuesday edition of Main Street on today's All Things Considered. Federal judges, they get certain perks. What happens when they don't meet the responsibilities of disclosing those perks? Coming up tomorrow on Main Street, some talented local musicians will be performing on NPR's From the Top. We'll get to meet them. That's tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.